The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 28th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Anthony Lowenstein, journalist, author of Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of a Catastrophe. Also on the program today, Chicago cops tampering with their dash cams. I wonder why they do that. Maybe they're just shy. Also on the program, the Washington Post editorial board boasting 27 pro-Iraq war editorials. Says Bernie Sanders needs a reality check. In a related story, I imagine his poll numbers just shot up. Meanwhile, Sanders agrees to more debates if there are more debates. And Trump and Fox, seems like the ink has dried on their divorce papers. Who will get the kids? I don't know. Tonight, we're going to try for a picture-in-a-picture broadcast of the debates with audio, and then in the inset will be Trump's event for the Wounded Warriors, considered a slightly dubious. I mean, apparently they do some good, and they just make a lot of money off it, which is always good for a charity. And we'll be able to watch both simultaneously tonight on our coverage starting at 9 p.m. Eastern. It'll probably start at about quarter of. And meanwhile, in Oregon, two more of those Y'all-Qaedas have scurried out of their holes. But apparently there's a couple of them in there who are really calling for Americans to come and stand beside them as they, I don't know, they were, as far as I could tell in this video, they were operating a federally owned, I think this was an excavator. I think it was bigger than a backhoe. It looked pretty big. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. You can also support your habit of drinking coffee. Statistics show that 94% of you drink coffee at least one time a week. I completely made that up. But it sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Now, if 94% of you listening to the sound of my voice right now purchase Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop, you'd go there, you'd find you had multiple varieties of coffee that you could choose from. All fair trade, so no one gets screwed in the process. It's a co-op-owned company. So the employees, I should say, own the company. And you would get 10% off the thousands upon thousands of dollars that would be saved if you use that coupon code at Majority. I don't know where I was going this, but justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, 10% off. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You will enjoy the coffee. We will enjoy the kickbacks, essentially. And speaking of kickbacks, if you purchase stuff from Jeff Bezos, owner of the Washington Post, and you want to kick back some of those profits to us, you should do so by purchasing your Amazon stuff through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. If you don't want to get involved in any of that, you want to check out jet.com, a similarly situated service with, according to reporting I've seen, extremely happy employees. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on that jet.com link. We get a kickback. And I think if you go first-time buyers, get 15% off. So check it out. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to go to Anthony Lowenstein. He is in Berlin, as far as I understand it. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program columnist for The Guardian UK, journalist and author of Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of a Catastrophe, Anthony Lowenstein. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on. How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, let's start with the title, Disaster Capitalism. I think many in this audience would be familiar with that term. First coined, I believe, by Naomi Klein in her book,
Shock Doctrine.
Shock Doctrine.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And tell us where you pick up this story of disaster capitalism.
So for me, I define it as people or organizations making money from misery. So that could be through immigration, war, aid in development, or resources or mining. And I was inspired by Naomi's book. I think it's a wonderful book. She actually endorsed my book. So there's obviously a similarity of thought. But the difference, I guess, is that I have a large focus in my book on immigration. And immigration is a massive issue, both here in Europe, but also in the US, the UK, and Australia, my home country. And the fact that there is a massive and growing industry of organizations making a huge profit from that industry. That could be from detention centers to guards to those providing food. And the US, for example, that could be everything from prisons to also immigration. And of course, the two largest private prison detention center companies in the US, CCA and Geo Group, have interests in both prisons and detention centers for immigration. So for me, the book covers a range of countries from Afghanistan to Haiti to Papua New Guinea, the US, UK, Greece, and Australia. But I guess the big difference, especially, is a focus on immigration, which is incredibly topical, as it, unfortunately, for all the wrong reasons.
Right. And this is, I mean, when we talk about refugees and we talk about immigration, there's every reason to believe this is a growth industry, right? I mean, because we've seen a huge uptick in particularly refugees as a function of not just war, but also climate change, as we have food shortages, as we have floods and or droughts.
Absolutely. And one of the things that the United Nations released a study late last year in 2015 saying that roughly 60 million people, or I think that a number was one out of every 122 people on the planet, have been displaced. That's an astounding figure. And that's partly war, partly climate change, partly other reasons as well. And they're looking for asylum, for safety. And that could be in Europe, it could be the US, it could be Australia, it could be a range of countries, mostly in the West. But we shouldn't forget, and this is often ignored in much of the debate, that the majority of refugees in the world are not coming into the West. They're actually staying in neighboring countries to their own countries, or as an example, the Syria crisis. The Europeans at the moment, of course, are struggling to deal with these huge numbers of people who are coming from the Middle East. But the truth is that the majority of Syrian refugees are actually going to Turkey, or they're going to Jordan or Lebanon. And those countries aren't dealing with the issue very well either, for that matter. But they're not coming to Europe. And I think there's such a misnomer about how this debate is framed. And one of the things I try to focus on, which is a bit different to what a lot of other people are arguing, is the private aspect to this. So the European Union, which listeners will be aware, is really making a ham-fisted effort at managing the refugees that are coming in from North Africa and the Middle East, are increasingly using private corporations to manage or warehouse the problem. And as we've seen in the US or the UK or Australia, I argue in the book through my investigations in all those places that by following the lead of those countries, the European Union is making the absolute opposite right way of managing the problem. Because if you think that by giving contracts to private corporations to spend as little as money as possible on healthcare and food and housing, you're actually going to deter people from coming. Because ultimately, what privatized immigration is supposed to be deterrence. It's not said to be that publicly, but that's the reality. That it's, in other words, the idea is to make life as difficult as possible for someone living or staying in these detention camps. That's what we see in the US as well, with immigrants coming mostly from Central America.
So, all right. So, I mean, if this is, if there's a sort of an unspoken policy of like, we're going to do this on the cheap, and it's a twofer for us because there's no accountability in terms, or there's far less accountability for the way that these refugees or immigrants are treated. And so it functions in two ways. One, we spend less money. We have no accountability, and we can then essentially achieve a deterrence factor without having to really fully own it. There are two things that strike me or that I'm curious about. Is one is like, what is this simply a Western phenomena in terms of this privatization? Because it seems to me, and I don't have a sense, but it seems to me that you have really bad conditions with refugee camps, let's say Syrian refugee camps in the countries that are border or at least are close to Syria.
Absolutely correct. As I was saying before, you're right that in places like Lebanon or Turkey, for that matter, or Jordan, the vast bulk of refugees fleeing from Syria go to those places. And they're either living in incredibly poor refugee camps, or they're living in the community with very few, if any, work rights, no protection, etc. So what I'm, I guess, arguing is that in the book, that if the European Union increasingly views the issue of refugees as one to be solved by building walls and fences and using drones, not to kill people, but to monitor borders, which is exactly what the European Union is doing. They are following the lead of what the US and Australia and the UK have been doing for years now, because ultimately, to me, and through my research, I really say that there's no interest in actually trying to resolve the reasons why people are fleeing in the first place. Like, that's the ultimate issue here. So if you make a decision as an authority body to not really try to resolve the war in Syria or try to deal with climate change or try to resolve the war in Afghanistan or Iraq, and arguably the West, especially the US, is exacerbating those wars by their own actions, you are guaranteeing more people fleeing. I mean, if you're a Syrian who can afford it in any way, shape or form, of course you're going to leave the country. The country basically doesn't exist anymore as any entity. It's basically it's beyond a failed state now, as any listener will know. And the problem is that when you rely increasingly on private interests and private corporations to solve your problems, you are, as you said before, causing more problems, because in the short term, you may see it as a solution, but in the long term, as I've reported in the US and Australia, the conditions, the sexual abuse, the healthcare problems in all those countries for refugees actually is getting worse, because the state is increasingly relying on private interests to provide those services. That's the problem. But I should also say that I'm not arguing that, well, if all the centres for refugees in, say, the US were run by the state, that would be okay. The ultimate problem to me is that we have a warehousing culture that somehow believes that locking people up for a long time or even a short time is the solution, and ultimately it's not. So the issue is not just that a certain facility is run by a private company. This is a cultural and ideological question, ultimately. And to me, the US particularly, including in your current presidential race, just very briefly, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and Hillary Clinton have all taken huge amounts of money from the private prison and immigration companies over the last years. And their own policies on those questions, so that's the Democrats and the Republicans, are pretty shoddy. In fact, they're appalling. And the idea somehow that these corporations themselves, I'm talking about CCA now and Geo Group, fear any kind of serious reform in these questions, what Obama is doing in a very, very, very small way, even though he's still deporting far too many people, they don't fear those reforms because, as they in fact say themselves, by funding both some of the politicians but also huge amounts of money on lobbying, they're pretty confident that in the short term at least, there's little chance that there'll be seriously less people behind bars every night. That's the reality for these companies today.
And we should note, I mean, just to be, since it is primary season, Bernie Sanders has proposed legislation to basically bar federal dollars for federal prisons. I mean, I want to shift to Haiti, but I also just wanted to just remark that the refugees that are on and I may be mispronouncing this, it's the Manus Island detention and Nauru,
yes.
I think it is
Nauru.
It's just shocking.
It really is.
Tell people about that, because I was sort of in some ways, yeah. It's sort of, I guess, like mirrors how Australia's origins were.
Absolutely.
I'll briefly explain.
I mean, I think there is a sense, like if you ask most people outside Australia, including in the US, and I spend a lot of time in the US, the image of Australia is of a kind of relaxed, sunny, chilled out country. And in many ways, that's true. However, and it's a very big however, for the last 20 years or so, Australia has treated refugees, mostly coming from the Middle East, but also in the last years from Sri Lanka, so Tamils particularly, in an incredibly brutal way. So many refugees are sent to Pacific Island prisons, essentially, detention camps in Nauru and Manus Island, which is in Papua New Guinea, can't leave, are there indefinitely. There's a mandatory detention. The centres are run for profit by either British companies or Australian companies. The litany of sexual abuse allegations, rape allegations, poor food, poor healthcare is absolutely off the chart. And in some ways, and I hate to admit this as an Australian, it has a lot of support. And in some ways it has the support because a lot of Australians, I think, who, as you rightly say, Australia is a classic colonial country, as is the US, as is New Zealand, as is Israel. I think there's a real connection between nations that have a colonial history that somehow fear the idea of a perception of their own country being taken by others, which is the ultimate irony, because, of course, when the British came to Australia in the late 1700s, they were taking the land off indigenous population in the first place.
Right.
But a lot of Australians, I think, support this policy because it's out of sight, out of mind. And like a lot of Americans, frankly, which I think partly explains the big support, certainly on one side of the population for someone like Donald Trump, is it's a fear, I guess, of accepting a difference, but also it's out of sight, out of mind. So the idea somehow that Australia can lock people up indefinitely who are mostly Muslim, and in a post 9/11 environment, just like the US, is a great deal of fear and fear mongering against Muslims. So when there's a terrorist attack in, say, Paris, or a terrorist attack somewhere else, Australian politicians, not all of them, but many of them, and for that matter, a lot in the media, make a connection between the people who are fleeing these regimes from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, to terrorism, which is an absurd concept. I mean, a lot of the people who are fleeing these regimes and coming to Australia are actually, ironically, the kind of people that Australian troops are being sent there to apparently support. I mean, it's a crazy, cruel irony, right? And the US as well. So Australia has set up almost a two Pacific gulags, and I use those terms deliberately, and run for profit. And the sad thing is, I had a piece in The Guardian last week that the European Union, struggling to deal with its own refugee crisis, is increasingly looking at Australia as a model. And that partly involves outsourcing the problem to private corporations that deal with your issues, which is a worry.
How do those refugees get to those? In other words, are they coming via boat, or are these refugees that are landing in Sydney without papers? I mean, from a European perspective, I can understand it insofar as there are people coming across the borders. But how does it happen in the context of Australia?
So in Australia, the majority of people we're talking about are boat people, are asylum seekers coming by boat. So absolutely, as you say, they are, if you're someone from the Middle East, you are often coming by plane to Malaysia, to Indonesia, and then you were taking a boat, a dangerous journey to Australia. That has pretty much stopped in the last couple of years because the Australian Navy, with help from private interests, has pretty much gone out and pushed back any asylum seeker boat that attempts to enter Australian waters in an incredibly brutal way. So it's almost like Australia, which is an island, has decided to become almost not just an unwelcoming place. Australia still takes refugees, to be sure. But if you arrive by plane, and if you're British, or if you're white, or if you're American for that matter, you're much more likely to get refugee status. There is a weird sense in Australia of a long-term fear of people arriving by boat. And it's the ultimate irony, again, because Australia was colonized by British colonists coming by boat. And in Australia today, in the 21st century, there's a real, not just a fear, but a almost an irrational feeling that somehow Australia is vulnerable in the north from either Indonesia or China, which partly explains why Australia is so close to the US and has a lot of US bases around the country. So the US is framed as a protector of Australia against what used to be different forces and today would be seen as a supposed threat from China. And the Obama administration in the last 8 years has very much accentuated this idea somehow. You know, people may have heard about the so-called Asian pivot that President Obama has talked about. What that really practically means is increasingly militarizing the Asia-Pacific area to oppose any kind of rise of China in that region, and Australia is central to that.
Yes, and presumably the commercial version of this pivot, as opposed to the military pivot, is also is the TPP.
Absolutely.
Which, I don't want to get too caught up in that. I mean, I had spent some time in Australia, close to 30 years now, and there was at this time a real concern of the Japanese in particular, but there was a real concern that there was a real animosity towards immigration. Immigration to Australia, and which was ironic because you have like a city like Melbourne, I think, which has the second largest Greek population, in the world, if I remember correctly.
In Melbourne, which actually is my birth city, which is in the southern part of the country, has the largest Greek population in the world outside Greece. So it's large, very, very large. And, I mean, it's irony, really, because Australia is an immigrant country. I mean, it has people from all over the world. And in many ways, I don't want listeners to think that Australia is not integrated and made Australia a very multicultural country. It has, and it's pretty successful. However, there is a profound anger and vitriol towards people coming by boat. And as I said, now for 20 or so years, with both sides of politics in my country, so regardless of whether, say, a Democrat or Republican, which in Australia is Labor or Liberal or in power, there is a tendency to want to punish refugees coming by boat. And that, to me, is an incredibly ugly stain on Australia's record, frankly.
All right. Well, Anthony, let's make our own pivot, because I want to talk about Haiti. And I want to say also, just sort of, you know, generally speaking, the idea of, you know, what I found in your book is it's more granular in some respects than Naomi Klein's book. And one of the things that it sort of occurs to me on some level, as we are dealing with a really horrible crisis in Flint, Michigan, which, as people are starting to unravel this thing, one theory is that there was basically an attempt ultimately to privatize the water system in Flint, Michigan, and this was a mechanism in which to do so. That's what I found sort of relevant about your book at this time. And one of the other things is the story of Haiti. We have talked to folks about the case of the Red Cross and the enormous amount of money it raised for Haiti that seems to have evaporated. But apparently that dynamic, this notion of all the money that was raised for Haiti and it not seeming to have ever reached the Haitian people, is a dynamic that you explore in your book. Let's talk about that, because it is, and to a certain extent, I mean, it doesn't have direct bearing on our primary. I doubt it will even come up in most sectors. But part of it is an indictment of the State Department under Hillary Clinton.
Absolutely.
And in some sort of a bank shot, a little bit of the sort of the Clinton Foundation work. I mean, tell us about Haiti.
Usually. So the book focuses mostly on Haiti post-earthquake. So listeners may remember there was an earthquake in January 2010 that was devastating and killed, no one quite knows how many people, but anywhere between 1,000 to 300,000 people. And there was a huge international outcry. There was massive amounts of support pledged. The U.S. under the Obama administration talked about giving $10 billion in aid. Various governments and corporations went down there under the guise of helping, and the American Red Cross, as you say, was one of them, and that's been a complete disaster because all the money the Red Cross raised within the U.S. has mostly not gone to the Haitian people at all, and who knows where it's actually gone, frankly. So what I focus on, though, really is to say that when you have a modern natural disaster like the Haitian earthquake, and there are obviously other examples we could give, what is the international response and is it the appropriate response? And a key point that I talk about in relation to Haiti is that how the U.S. money, so much of USAID money coming from the State Department and indeed other organizations like the Clinton Foundation, which was, well, Hillary, Bill and Chelsea, but Hillary was in theory at least not involved at the time because she was Secretary of State, but there's evidence to suggest that she, in fact, was involved, at least covertly, that most of the money that was pledged actually never left the U.S. What I mean by that is that the U.S. USAID was giving contracts to U.S. contractors to go down to Haiti and rarely, if ever, hire Haitians themselves. So when you go to Haiti, and I've been there twice in the last years, you find some changes in the last years, some benefits. There's definitely been a few new roads built. I'm not going to say nothing has improved in the last 5 years, but ultimately virtually nothing has improved. And that's because the U.S.'s relationship with Haiti is not based on one of equals. It sees Haiti as a client state. It's seen Haiti like that for 100 years. Over successive decades, various dictators, the U.S. government, Republican or Democrat, have viewed Haiti as a place to make cheap clothing for American consumers. So that's why you have Gap and Walmart and a range of other clothing companies, often making their clothes in so-called industrial parks in Haiti, basically words for sweatshops. And I spent time in some of those places in Haiti, and they're pretty awful. They're not as grim, potentially, as some of the sweatshops you read about in China making iPhones, but they're pretty bad. And one of the key people who are backing industrial parks or sweatshops is Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. And they made huge pledges and promises to Haiti, both before 2010 when the earthquake hit and since. And none of those have actually come to fruition, like none of them. And the question, as I talk about in the book, and I've said this in the press in the last 6 months or so, is if American media was actually serious about vetting potential presidential candidates, and sadly most of the mainstream media is not, Hillary's record in Haiti would be front and center. Front, as it would be Libya as well for that matter, but Haiti would be front and center. And the Clinton Foundation's record there is so poor, and a lot of Haitians themselves have said this, that they wonder where all the support that the Clinton Foundation pledged to make to Haiti is actually gone. Listeners might not be aware that Bill and Hillary have had a love affair, that's their word, with Haiti because they had their honeymoon there many, many years ago. And since that, they have unfortunately lavished a hell of a lot of support on Haiti, but in Clinton himself, Bill Clinton, when he was president, gave a lot of pressure on Haiti to accept very, very bad trade deals that essentially forced Haitian farmers to not grow their own crops, and American farmers were able to import their own crops into Haiti. So a quick, short example. So the earthquake happened 5 years ago, and Haiti didn't actually need really any food, but because there was a very bad trade deal signed years before, Haiti had no choice but to import food from the US. So Haitian farmers are in Haiti saying, we have food here to support our own people. That food was rotting. That's one quick example. And Bill, to his credit, actually has come out and apologized for those dodgy trade deals in the last couple of years. So to me, I think the relationship between Haiti and the US really goes to the heart of how disaster capitalism is at the center of US foreign policy towards countries that are potentially seen as useful to the US. And that means useful politically, useful economically. And I'll finish on this point. You know, WikiLeaks released some cables a number of years ago, listeners will be aware, and one of the US ambassadors at the time in Haiti said that essentially that Haiti was a gold rush, for US corporations to make money. That's how the US viewed that country.
And I should say, I mean, I'm actually looking at one of those cables now that in 2012, after Haiti had passed a law raising its minimum wage to 61 cents an hour, both Haynes and Levi Strauss and some other American corporations objected. And this is according to the leaked U.S. embassy cable. Ultimately, the U.S. ambassador put pressure on the president of Haiti to find a middle ground, resulting in a what ended up being a $3 a day minimum wage for these textile
Absolutely.
Companies. And, and we're talking about an increase in cost in millions of dollars, maybe a couple of millions of dollars a year for a company like Haynes, which had a $4.3 billion in revenue that year. I mean, but I imagine in this situation for a company like that, I mean, you know, I mean, I've come to understand that it's not even necessarily we want to save $1 million. It's we want to stop the precedent of any type of upward push in wages. So the actual dollar figure is less relevant than the sort of symbolic or political momentum. But let me ask, give us an example. I mean, it's one thing for the Clinton Foundation to say we're going to do X, Y, and Z, and they never deliver. I mean, give us a sense of what, I mean, to the extent that that you've reported it, give us a sense of where it goes beyond that, because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to just leave it there with a sort of blanket sense that the Clinton Foundation was problematic to Haiti. As you've said, Bill Clinton negotiated trade deals that has really hurt Haitian agriculture. I could also argue NAFTA did the same thing to Mexico in many respects. But give us the specifics in terms of the Clinton Foundation, or at least an example.
Yeah, for sure. So after the 2010 earthquake, the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton, for that matter, talked about how it was vital to build these large industrial parks. And the centerpiece was going to be in Caracol, which is in the north of Haiti. They negotiated and assisted a South Korean company called Saya to come to the center and hire Haitian workers. Hillary and Bill go down to Haiti to announce the deal. They pledge there's going to be X number of tens of thousands of jobs. There'll be a certain kind of minimum wage. 5 years on, none of that has happened. And in fact, the numbers of people who have been employed is incredibly less than they promised. Secondly, the wages are poor. And to the point where when I was there a few years ago speaking to workers, none of them were particularly aware of the Clinton Foundation. Some of them were, but it was more a day-to-day basis that, the, as you rightly said, the wages had been pushed down so much that people barely had enough money to live on who were working in these centres and to couldn't have enough money to pay for transport, for food on every single day. So it's a, there was a key connection between the Clinton Foundation and Hillary actually pushing this particular South Korean company, Saya, to come to northern Haiti and establish a base to make clothes for the American market. And anyone can Google that and find out that the record of that promise and the record of that company, apart from actually being union busting and actually underpaying staff, is incredibly poor. And whenever Clinton herself is asked about this, she deflects. And the State Department itself also, under her, has also deflected. And sadly, I fear that if she's the candidate this year for the Democrats, I guess we'll wait and see if she is, I suspect she'll get barely any questions about it at all. And that's a shame because she deserves to have to answer for it.
I would imagine there'll be no questions about it. But with that said, I mean, that's just the reality of it. But with that said, I mean, to be fair, you know, I didn't do anything for Haiti either. And now I didn't go down there and make a big promise about it. But I don't, you know, I don't know the circumstances of why they did not deliver on those promises. But is that the same as promoting or hurting the Haitian people? In other words,
I think it is. I think it is. I think because there is a sense that if your main key argument for helping Haiti, as the Clinton Foundation, Hillary herself, as Secretary of State says, is basically getting private industry into Haiti to support Haitian people, that in theory might be fine. But if your centerpiece, which it was building these facilities in northern Haiti in Caracol, that's the name of the area, you have to be judged to me on what you deliver. I mean, that to me is just a given. And the truth is that the Clinton Foundation, it wasn't just them, it was others as well.
Right.
But particularly them and Hillary herself, that was the centerpiece. And a lot of people I spoke to when I was there said to me that this really goes to the heart of how the US has always seen Haiti, regardless of the rhetoric. The reality is that Haiti is seen as a client state of Washington, one, and secondly, a place where they can get cheap clothing made for American corporations or other countries who have other corporations that are friendly to the US. And South Korea, of course, is a ally of the US. So this is the relationship. And even now, in 2016, Haiti had an election recently. Listeners will may be aware. It was a complete shambles. There was massive fraud. There was going to be a runoff, which has now been cancelled because of so much fraud. And this goes back to the fact that the US, not just under Obama, but before that under Bush and for years and years and years, never actually wanted Haiti, which is the poorest country in its hemisphere, to be independent. You can be independent in name, and Haiti is independent on paper, for sure, has the seat of the UN, it's independent. But in reality, it relies far too much on the US. And in fact, just briefly, when there was an election 5 years ago, it was a complete shambles. Hillary, as Secretary of State, went down there to actually try to negotiate some kind of settlement. And in fact, the person who became Prime Minister, Michel Martelly, wasn't even in the race to actually be Prime Minister. And when that negotiation one day ended, he suddenly became a front runner. And all Haitians that you speak to know these facts. They know the fact that the US views Haiti as their plaything. And ultimately, the people who suffer are the Haitian people. And I've seen that myself when you go down there. And you sort of said before, you know, you weren't doing anything for Haiti. Sure, you know, we can't help everybody in the world. I understand that. But anyone who's interested in supporting a country like that, to me, it really is just about looking for NGOs or others who actually engage local people. It's not that hard to find that out, you know. Find out organizations that actually believe that it's important to help and train and fund and support locals. I'm not saying that you can't have American contractors ever going down to Haiti. Sure you can. But as long as you have locals being hugely trained, because when those American contractors leave, as most of the Americans did, nothing was left. The Haitians were sort of there, sort of saying, well, what's the legacy here? You know, we've got no benefit from these $10 billion that Obama pledged. That's the problem.
More broadly, I'm going to broaden this out, and sort of, is this a recent phenomenon? In other words, when we contribute to aid for countries, and much of that money is essentially exchanged in this country, let's say, or sent to a European country, and they send people there, and when they leave, as little as money as possible was sort of circulated in that country, right? I mean, you're not paying, local people. To the extent that you've built any infrastructure, it is infrastructure that almost is like airlifted in some respects, and you haven't built the cement companies that could build other places. You haven't built the infrastructure necessarily. You built maybe one school, but none of the sort of runoff that comes, none of the multiplier effects that we see in, let's say, expenditure on infrastructure in our own country is evident. Is that a new phenomena, or is simply the pretense sort of new, because there is people who are saying like, hey, this is a gold rush and I'm going to get into this business because I'm going to make this money.
Well, in some ways, it's an interesting question. I mean, clearly, as I was saying before, in a place like Haiti or many other countries, the US and other Western states have long had very unequal relationships with these countries. So until there has been in the last maybe 30 years or so, the language of aid and development and NGOs has changed, I think, how we in the West view developing countries. And in some ways, that can be very positive. You have a lot of support that American and British and Australian NGOs and European NGOs will give to various countries, and that can assist infrastructure building and human development. I'm not saying that that's all bad. The opposite, in fact. The problem is, to me, two things. One, that very often there is a lack of accountability about those kind of activities. So I think it's worrying that in, say, the case of Haiti, or for that matter, Afghanistan, which also features in my book, very quickly, the US has spent in Afghanistan since 2001, when they invaded in October, $110 billion. That is the most amount of money on any kind of so-called nation building for a hell of a long time. It's been a complete disaster. Yes, there have been a few new schools and a few new nice benefits around Afghanistan, but the majority of that money has gone to either corruption or disappeared. And to me, that really goes to the heart of where government-directed aid industry can actually be problematic. So if you, in Afghanistan, for example, the US has done, and they did in Iraq the same thing, post 9/11, they chose to spend a lot of aid money on projects that didn't have any follow through, or they chose to support warlords in Afghanistan or Iraq to help protect certain areas. Or in Afghanistan, for example, there's been a lot of US government reports themselves talking about how when the US military was trying to transport goods around the country, so military hardware or anything else, they were paying security contractors who were on paying the Taliban to make sure that the Taliban wouldn't shoot or attack those US convoys. That's what USAID and US support often has meant. So when you have a situation today, like in 2016, where the US war in Afghanistan is a complete and utter disaster, that has a lot to do with the fact that the US made a decision many years ago to support warlords and not the Taliban. The whole framing in Afghanistan is all about the Taliban or nothing, or the Taliban or Hamid Karzai, or the Taliban or Ashraf Ghani, who's the current leader. fundamentally misunderstands Afghan society. So much of the USA, like tens of billions of dollars, has gone into projects like building roads and building schools in areas where there's no chance of those projects being delivered. And you'd be amazed, even the US government itself now puts out regular reports talking about how US contractors weren't even checked on to finish the work, but didn't stop them getting more contracts. That's the fundamental problem with US aid and Australian British aid as well. There is little accountability for the money that is being spent. And that's because in the countries themselves, the US, Australia, the UK, there's not much political outrage about this. Like, when was the last time, apart from maybe a day or so, there's a huge scandal that, say, the Democrats or the Republicans get upset about this? In other words, there's not thousands of people marching down the street in Washington, D.C., demanding more accountability. That's the problem. So the U.S. government or the British government or the Australian government can spend a hell of a lot of aid money, often outsource it now to private contractors. These things are not being delivered upon, and yet there's virtually no accountability for that. And I talk about that extensively in the book, why that is and how it could be different.
I mean, it seems to me like a lot of it is just sort of like a tremendous amount of inertia that is enhanced and enabled by all the lobbying, right? So it's just, there just seems to be, you know, getting money to spend in Afghanistan, probably in the context of spending money, not that hard to do, relative to, let's say, spending money on providing food stamps, even. I mean, because it's not politically charged, and it is in the name, so, theoretically, of homeland security. And so and you've got a bunch of lobbyists who are saying, you know, we've got people on the ground there, we have the operations, or we can deliver this or that. And then throughout the entire process, there's a certain amount of inertia and no real need to deliver, and so why rock the boat?
For sure, and this is one of the things that when Obama was a candidate in 2007, he pledged to unwind or at least challenge the Bush administration's crony capitalism post 9/11. And the truth is that since Obama's been in, nothing has changed. It's actually got worse since he's been in power. So this idea somehow that you favor companies who are your friends. And the Republicans did this very, very well from their perspective. But the Democrats actually have been no different. And this has been the real tragedy among so many other tragedies of the Obama years, that all those companies who were rewarded post 9/11 in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya and elsewhere in the so-called war on terror actually have continued gaining more contracts during the Obama years, despite the fact that Obama administration is releasing reports explaining how incompetent these companies are. Now, a listener will hear that and say, hang on a second, how's that even possible? It's possible for two reasons. One, there's virtually no political pressure to change it. Two, there are a handful of companies that are able to manage certain kinds of contracts in certain kind of countries. So there aren't that many companies who can, for example, help train an Iraqi or Afghan military. I mean, those trainings have been a complete disaster. As any listener will know, that the Afghan-Iraqi army has been rife with problems, I mean, to put it mildly. So there's that problem. And thirdly, and this is where it comes to the accountability question, speaking to a lot of people, as I do in the book, over the years about why there's been little accountability, they say that there's such massive turnover in these kind of organizations. I'm talking about USAID. I'm talking about the US military. So you have soldiers go to Afghanistan. The rotation is 6 months, 9 months, 1 year. New people come in. Institutional memory disappears. Mm. New people get put in place. And that's not an excuse. That's simply an explanation. So when there's an attempt to try to bring accountability for a failed contract to build a road or build a school or build some kind of infrastructure, the people who did it have left the country. They've moved on to Iraq or they're back in the US or whatever it may be. That's the key problem. And Obama, although he pledged to change that, actually has not at all. And that's been a real disaster.
Lastly, I mean, I know we're over time here, and I appreciate you giving us this time. How would you address that? I mean, that lack of an institutional memory seems very difficult to combat. I mean, I've even seen that in the context of
of enterprises I've been involved here that are not in a war zone, that are in a nice office building, and you know, where theoretically, although it was trying at times, it was not too hard for me to be in that context. I witnessed, you know, sort of a, I guess, a failure as a function of no institutional memory. You get a different leadership in every 12 months, and everybody keeps making the same mistakes, and then they move on to the next gig.
Yeah, I mean, there's no simple answer, so let me preface my answer by saying that. But there's two possible ways, and this, of course, is arguably one of the key issues facing America in general. Lobbying has fundamentally corrupted the U.S. political system. I mean, it's such an obvious, self-evident thing for anyone who looks into the American political system that lobbying, both by anyone from aid organizations, I'm talking about private aid organizations, to, I don't mean the idea of lobbying by definition, I'm talking about lobbying for financial contracts. Mm. I'm talking about the idea that, for example, organizations who have consistently failed to deliver can keep on getting contracts. I think to me, and it seems obvious, but obviously it hasn't happened, that I don't think that corporations who are operating, for example, in war zones should be able to donate money. I mean, obviously the Supreme Court disagrees, which is why they said that, you know, a corporation basically is a person. But that, to me, Citizens United, that decision, which of course this problem existed long before that, but that really solidified the issue. That, to me, has to stop. And I think there's also, it has to become a direction from the top. I mean, Obama, as an example, and of course is about to be a new president next year in the US, made a decision, like with torture, like with rendition, like with various other things, to not prosecute, like with Wall Street. This direction comes from the top. If you make a decision as a president, as an administration, to not bring accountability to organizations or individuals who have allegedly committed crimes, why would you expect those crimes to stop?
Right.
I mean, you know, what's the incentive to do so? And that, to me, would only happen if there's enough political pressure within the US to do so. And until, to me, there is a more than a two-party system in the US, which I know is a long way away, like in most Western countries, that's unlikely to happen. There are so few Democrats who are willing to challenge Obama during these years. There are some, but not many. And the same on the Republican side as well, of course. And it's similar in my country and the UK too, that this sort of blind allegiance to a political, not just a political party, but a political ideology. Disaster capitalism actually reaches across the aisle. This is not one side or the other. The Republicans are worse, to be sure, but the Democrats on this issue have turned just as much of a blind eye to this as the Republicans. And that's damning on a party that claims to represent the common man and woman.
Right. Well, thank you so much for your time. The book is Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. Anthony Lowenstein, we will link to that book on our page at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me. Bye-bye. Cheers.
All right, folks. The guy was a total emo prog.
Yeah. Bernie, bro.
We're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half. I mean, I'm on the emo prog thing because last night I was on Hayes's show talking about this whole debate kerfuffle. Now, the Republicans have the sort of the marquee debate kerfuffle, but the Democrats have their own debate kerfuffle. And I will break it down just like I did last night on Hayes. And I mean, look, I think it's quite clear because I feel like I've made it quite clear that who I'm going to vote for in the primary. And I think it's also quite clear. I mean, we don't know who the candidate will be, but I think it's quite clear who I'll be voting for in the general.
I'm going to vote for Bernie in the primary because, like, I'm wicked into single-payer healthcare, and I do not want a chick to be president. I'm a Bernie bro, dude. It's my politics.
And
I'm, like, wicked for Haitian human rights and wicked not into girls running things.
But last night, I just outlined and assessed the dynamic that was going on in terms of the debates. And I got a lot of like of tweets. Now, I'm not a sensitive person, and but there are times where I pretend like I am. And I was forced last night to pretend like I was offended by some of the tweets. And so I find that really upsetting in many ways. I find that really upsetting. So we'll talk about that. And I should give you an update, because on the end of the program yesterday, I had talked about a buddy of mine who is in Great Britain and had a colleague listen to the program. And apparently she responded that I sounded like an 80-year-old man, as if the podcast was held in the 1950s. Because I was extrapolating and explaining why people say that Hillary Clinton is one of the most qualified candidates ever to be president of the United States. And I was outlining why the why that argument is made. She has the best knowledge of what it takes to be president because of, not just because she was senator, we certainly had one-term senators before, not just because she was Secretary of State, we certainly had cabinet members in the past. I don't know if we've had any Secretary of States that have run, but that is definitely, but also because of the close proximity in which she could observe a president for 8 years.
Whoa. Whoa, dude.
Because
slow your roll.
Now, in the fun half, we talked about why I wouldn't want Laura Bush to be president just for having been first lady. But apparently, she didn't listen to the fun half of the program. And her response was, I mean, I'm going to read it right now, actually. I mean, she didn't, it's secondhand, via a man. She said, this is her response. I love it. Even the British bashing. I did bash the British. I did. I thought she was British, but apparently she's not. Apparently she's American. but all the stuff
well,
I said.
Indeed.
Well, whatever. I mean, she sounds like suspiciously Canadian to me, but put that aside.
Sexist, eh?
She said, I'm so glad his colleagues don't think he's sexist. So, which in some way I find, I'm sort of offended on behalf of you guys, because, yeah, it's very condescending. And then she said, Laura Bush for president. Now, I made it clear in the fun half, apparently she didn't listen that long, that it's a different situation, because obviously Hillary Clinton parlayed her experience in the White House as an advisor, a close advisor to Bill Clinton. And we said, Laura Bush, probably not the same advisor in the same dynamic as, let's say, Eleanor Roosevelt is not the same first lady as Laura Bush or Barbara Bush, for that matter. And Hillary Clinton had major accomplishments as first lady. She did not succeed when it came to healthcare reform, but there was a lot of work done in that. And the work itself was an accomplishment. So, and that's it. So those are that's the extent of the comments, but
I still don't understand it.
Well, you're my colleague and that's why.
Well, you're definitely not sexist. And I still don't understand how the comment is sexist. You know, Laura Bush had the same type of access, but not seemingly the same type of aspirations, and that's fine. That is feminism.
Wow.
You know.
Well, but I mean, we can all. It's very likely that we heard something like, "Laura, shut up! I'm going to invade Iraq." That's it. Period.
Stop trying to force me to invade Iraq, Laura.
Oh, you're saying that?
Sorry, did I mistype that joke for you?
No.
It's a different partnership, like every marriage.
Yes.
And she
That's
and
right.
They're both fine.
That's right.
I think the 1950s style broadcast and sounding like your 80s legitimate as a
I mean,
colleague.
Look, yeah. I mean, it's not like I mean, it's certainly arguable. That's fine. I mean, I think that's true. Last night on Hayes, I said hoisted by their own petard. And someone pointed out like that was like it was like hashtag middle-aged man.
I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, I know. I don't think it's been used since the Dark Ages, actually. Yeah. Apparently a petard is a high-walled the walls of a castle. And
Jesus Christ, you're sexist. We gotta take all right, let's go.
All right, so let's go, guys, to the to the fun half. We'll be right back. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Or 1-800 He-Man Women Haters Club. You can IM me via our Machismo app. Don't forget, tonight we'll be doing a live debate coverage with picture in a picture of Donald Trump's rally. We'll be right back after this.
But